Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, good morning, everybody. Today is, of course, Monday. It's April 5, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Should be a nice spring day in the 50s, maybe even as high as 60. So we're moving on into the spring and into the summer, which is very, very exciting. Well, we've got some fantastic guests for you today. We're going to begin the morning with John Bailey. He's a White Plains Citizenet reporter, publisher, and editor. Then we're going to move on at 10:30 with Michael Edelman, Esquire. He's a national political analyst and pundit. At 11 o'clock, we're going to speak to Amy Bove. She's a co-chief operating officer of We Shield. And in the last half hour, it'll be you and I together. We'll talk about other items as well. I see that John is already on the line. Good morning, John. What a pleasure to have you on. I hope you had a good weekend.
Good morning from White Plains, New York, USA.
Well, you know, I was very interested to read on WPCNR or WhitePlainsCitizenetReporter.com website that you and Mr. Philippides had gotten together over the weekend, and you actually went down memory lane over the last 20 years. How was that? That had to be very, very exciting.
Well, what was most exciting and revelatory was the minor issues that occupied us back in those days. You know, whether the Common Council would give us a tax increase, whether a developer would have two towers instead of one. And these were just, this was normal. And now it's just totally different. We have the entire way government reacts to things being challenged.
And is it because there's greater complexity to the issues that we're covering now, and it was less complex then, or what's the catalyst of driving it that way, or have you been able to figure that out yet? I think it's a question that everyone's asking. No answer.
Well, things have been turned completely upside down. You have corporations now getting along just fine with people working from home. They are moving. They are not renewing leases in New York City on their office buildings. And this is really going to hurt New York City in the future. And the question is, how many will close down the offices? So shutting down the amount of consumer activity from the businesses. And this is what New York is going to have to face. We don't know whether things will return to 75% of normal, 80%, or less than that. We don't know.
I think it'll be less, because New York City will be a place where people can live, but not necessarily have all those things that we used to have in New York. I hear Broadway is opening up in May or something like that. All the restaurants are not going to reopen. So it's going to be a place where you can live, and the people that will live there will most likely be singles and young couples. And if and when they have children, maybe they'll move to the suburbs when we'll get them. And
right,
there isn't that much traffic on the subway. And I don't mean the subway, the Metro North.
Right. That was brought home. I mean, we were told by Senator Schumer in a pep talk press conference. That's the only thing I can really describe it. MTA is going to get billions for their improvement program and long-term program. And I'm thinking, hold on a minute. They are not back up to 33% yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're still way down in ridership. And where is that revenue going to come from? Is this a is going to be used for replacement revenue? And I mean, the subways are supposedly in bad shape, but they're not. They're doing a lot of work on them. And the question is,
people are not traveling on Metro North. So what's the point?
No, they certainly aren't. They're staying and working at home. And now we have this congestion pricing. And what people are doing, that is going to be now supported, and we don't know when it will come in, but they are, the federal government, Biden administration, has approved congestion pricing experiment in New York, basically for an anti-pollution measure. But that may spur return to the rails. However, even when I was going in to see New York City plays, I never took the train because it was a darned inconvenience. We found a nice, inexpensive place to park and just walk to the theater. And, I mean, that was our strategy. We did not like traveling on the train. And I never have. I love trains, and I like them for a long distance because you see a lot more. But commuting plays, I don't love that. Nobody does, right? So you take your car.
Nobody
does.
Exactly.
And you think people liked riding in those cramped subways? I don't think so.
I don't think either.
No. And I mean,
Do you think at the end of the day that what we did 20 years ago was more pertinent than it is today? Have things really changed? Are we talking about different issues?
Well, we're talking about jobs that were well-paying.
Yeah, but they're gone now.
They're certainly trimmed down a lot. I mean, corporate America has been absolutely been injected with most of the stimulus, in my opinion, because they were supposed to. I mean, the airlines totally bailed out. And my feeling is that there's been a lot of firings of people, and they weren't supposed to do that. The corporations that got aid weren't supposed to fire people. It was so they could keep them earning. But they did. And no government agency is doing anything about that.
Why aren't we clawing back the money that was supposed to keep them open?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, isn't it? A thought and a rule that is not enforced. How often do we see that? This Westchester County right here, Westchester County here says, wear masks, don't socially distance in big, big numbers, but no one enforces it. And you have to have some sort of enforcement, fines, etc. But then I'm just second guessing. We're trying to muddle it through and not get everybody mad. However, this whole business of refusing vaccinations is a big problem for the stopping COVID. It's a big problem because if you just don't know. Like this morning, I have workers in my home installing a rug, and a necessity because I had a backup in the interior line. But at any rate, have this problem of not enforcing persons who are irresponsible and want to ignore reality, break the rules anyway. And everybody is so pent up. I'm tired of seeing articles about, we have hit the wall and all that. No, you can't. You have to plow through the wall. That's what you have to go. And that's the
Very
way.
True. Very true.
Yes, that's. There's an old saying that used to be on an old boss of mine's office, The only way out is through.
Exactly. Very true.
Very true. We can't just mollycoddle the populace, you know?
No.
Oh, that's all right.
I want you to move on. I want you to move on and ask you about something else. The New York State Senate passed legislation that's going to end the prohibition of adult use marijuana in New York State, beginning on January 1 of 22. So that's like, what is it, about 9 months, 10 months away?
Yeah.
No, it should be like about 9 months. The question is, I know it's a big money maker, and so we needed an infusion of money because to take care of a lot of bills that are coming due, like schools, infrastructure, building, and so on and so forth. But is this not going to also displace a lot of people, particularly young people, whose only income was selling, you know, marijuana to everybody under the sun? And they took the money and gave it to mom and dad. That's how they survived. Now the bodegas are going to take that business. What are we going to do with all these kids with no food?
Well, they have to provide jobs. Supposedly the bodegas will hire them, right?
I don't think so.
But here's the situation. You say that many of the youth in the poorer neighborhoods of all races and creeds, you know, turn to minor drug trade, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really have any numbers on that.
No, nobody knew. It talked about
this
right.
We talked about it. So the question is there's going to be a major problem there, that way? I agree with you. Because you have to provide jobs for the younger person in the workforce, but of color, of Hispanic origin, and even the poor white population, of which there are quite a number. Just look at the food bank problem.
Well,
you have
absolutely.
A tremendous
and
hunger
it's
problem.
In every community
in
you go to.
You have to buy food and...
Yeah.
It is just not a laughing matter at all. I mean, that is the right front page of the Times today said that hunger is a huge problem that the Biden administration has to deal with. But, of course, so I think the whole marijuana problem is just going to aggravate the situation. I mean, if people are smoking more marijuana, they're going to have more issues. It is not a health drug.
Well, what about people who might be smoking and driving or might be smoking and crossing the street and not paying attention? A lot of these issues are going to come up. I don't think that they engaged in discussion of how to protect, you know, drivers and how to protect pedestrians who might be on the drug.
I believe they spoke with law enforcement, but I mean, we don't have that test yet, and they are working on it, and supposedly it's going to happen. But 9 months is a very short period of time. They're going to create an entire drug agency, a totally new government bureaucracy to handle marijuana, and. I'm waiting for the members of that commission now. I'm waiting for them. They should be in place now, and because they got a lot of thinking to do. We do not know what it's going to cost for licenses. How are bodegas, which have their own problems, going to be able to afford licenses? We didn't have any information on how much the licenses were going to cost. We didn't have information released on, you know, how many outlets could be owned by one operation. We didn't.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of questions about this, which were obvious, and the press hasn't asked them. They just haven't.
That's for
sure. Because it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing when the government is goes off half-cocked, which they often
do.
Very
true.
And I just think it hasn't been thought out.
Well, you're ahead of the curve. You interviewed Santino Thomas.
Yeah.
He's from the Associated Builders and Contractors of the Empire State. And he clarified the construction industry's concerns with respect to the newly passed marijuana legislation.
Yeah.
When you interviewed him, so what did you glean from him that was important to him and to the union?
Yeah. Well, what impressed me the most about the interview was the figure that 70% of contractors in New York State are non-union. Not union
yes,
shops.
That's right.
And
that's
that means three quarters of the firms that construct in New York are going to have a problem because they usually hire workers for per the job. They don't have a staff.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
now they used to be able to ask, you know, have you had any history of drug use? Can we? What do you have a criminal record? And according to the new law, they can't do that anymore.
Right.
You know, I'm just paraphrasing it. They're really expunging records for minor infraction of convictions,
right.
And that is a key element. And they also are subject to the scaffold law. There is a law passed in New York. In New York State, there is a law, the scaffold law is called. And and that came about when there was, a collapse of a building, and the person was killed, and it was in the courts. Then said that the construction company was liable. I'm paraphrasing the decision.
Right, I understand.
Okay. Yeah.
What happens?
Guy comes on to the site after you hire him, smokes marijuana before he goes on the job, and has an accident. Or kills somebody else by being careless. Not to say that they would. Nobody really wants to kill themselves, you know. And you have accidents, but you're more susceptible if you're high. So, and then, of course, there is a possibility of pushing on the site.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, or selling drugs illegally.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, so therefore, we've created more issues. Yeah. Well, they have
we've
to do
created
something
more
about
issues
that.
And mitigated.
Yes, and
well, they have to do a lot of things, but they don't do it. 20 years later, they still haven't done it.
Because they don't
40
think.
40 or 50 years later.
They do not think it through. But, I mean,
well,
this is also
problem.
Very anti-union. This is this is pro-union, this law, because if you are a non-union contractor now, you will have more leverage if you're dealing with a union which enforces this sort of stuff as part of your contract or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a real help to unions, and I think that is an absolute shame because I think unions are very important, but you can't give them an advantage over non-union workers by saying, look, you have to join the union if you want to work on these various non-union construction organization. So it's an intriguing offshoot. What?
But I got to ask you about that because at the end of the day, when you bring people onto like a site where they're working, you've got people who don't qualify for a lot of the expertise. They just get hired. But of what value is that when they don't have the expertise, they don't have the training? And who's liable for that?
Well, that raises a very valid point. However, if 70% of firms that do construction in New York State are non-union, what mm-hmm. does that tell you? It means that you'd be having a lot more problems with construction than you have. Mm-hmm. 70% is a huge, huge number. And so my feeling is that the unions are very good as for certain things, but unions make mistakes too.
Absolutely.
Union members.
Well, that's going to be...
No offense intended.
See where they go.
Yes.
No, not at all. It's not made to offend.
Yes, but they have to do something about the scaffold law. They have to do something about the scaffold law to prevent mm-hmm. companies from just being sued out of business.
Exactly.
Well, of course, it also helps the bigger construction companies that are union.
Absolutely. I want to ask you about Governor Cuomo. He says that for too long, the prohibition of cannabis disproportionately targeted communities of color with harsh mm-hmm. prison sentences. And after years of hard work, this landmark legislation provides justice for long marginalized communities, embraces a new industry that will grow the economy, and establishes, he said, substantially safety guards for the public. So would the marginalized community have alternate capacity to earn a living come about? And if so, how are they earning a living?
Well,
I don't get what he's talking about.
Well, theoretically, they'll be employed at some of the dispensaries and the retail outlets. They may get to be owners of them, but I'm telling you, how much does it cost for a license to become a marijuana retail outlet?
I don't know.
No.
That's a good question because shouldn't that cost something? Shouldn't that cost money?
Oh, it will.
You get a license for everything else.
It's a moneymaker for the government.
Well, that's what you're
It's like a retail liquor, right?
The intent.
Yeah.
I understand that was the intent of the government. They weren't doing it for nothing. They needed to make money because we owe so much money in back pay to schools, and we need to construct the art. The infrastructure is falling apart, and COVID has only informed us even more so how little was constructed.
Yes.
There's no point in rebuilding Metro North when so few people are using it, and even with the trains. And what about the buses? How many people are driving? How many people are going to take transportation in New York City? I don't know.
No, nobody knows. And I keep seeing that electric cars are becoming more and more popular, but not everybody in the metropolitan area feels like paying $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for a Tesla, you know?
Well, absolutely not, but we don't even
Forget it. The regular cars are expensive enough. My God.
Yeah, they are.
You have to pay $17,000 for a new car, a very small one.
Mm-hmm.
The last time I bought a car.
A Hummer, I don't know, it probably costs $50,000 to $75,000 an electric vehicle. But the point is, we don't have the infrastructure when you park the car to also charge it up. So where do you charge the car?
Always interesting.
Well, that becomes a real problem.
Yes, it does. On the highways, particularly the interstates.
Yeah. And what about the what do they call that? There's going to be new pricing to different sections of the city. How's that going to work when we have so much less travel in the city? You know, where they're going to charge if you go below a certain point in the city. I forgot what they call that system.
Well, That has never, it was, I think the deal is you have to, if you entered the city below 72nd Street or something like that, from Westchester particularly, or like coming in from Nassau County and Long Island, it will be, the traffic is bad enough without building the, and they'd have to do the easy pass read situation, because you can't put tolls on the West Side Highway.
I understand, but is traffic so bad? It's not the way it used to be. People are not coming into the city. So
not now.
Well, you think it might happen that in a year or two that it'll resuscitate?
That is
the restaurants are closed.
That is the great white hope.
Well, the restaurants are closed. Broadway is not packed as it used to be. And then what else do we have that's a problem? A lot of the big stores, fashion stores are closed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it has been a completely changed landscape.
Absolutely.
And, the carriage trade is heading to Westchester.
Are we planning for the future that is expressing itself now, or are we just wasting our time thinking that it's 2 years ago and we don't seem to be informed by anything?
That is the propaganda that is being put out, that we're going to be getting back to normal. There's going to be a new normal, and it's all safe to come back, and it might be. But businesses, always on a way to make buck, are limiting staffs, having people work from home. And as I mentioned at the outset of the program, they're not renewing their leases.
Correct.
On the big office
building. I don't believe the hype.
I want to see it happen. I mean, I'm not that keen to go to a Broadway show again. Depends on the, there are fire traps anywhere.
Well, there's a lot of local stuff in Westchester County really phenomenal.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are still. But, you know,
one of the best places was the Broadway Theater.
I know, but it doesn't take the place of Broadway itself. Because
no,
Broadway was
tourist.
Not just a show. It was also a restaurant. It was also a lot of other things. So,
yes.
I don't know.
And, of course, the tourist trade.
Absolutely. And the shopping that you could do.
Yeah.
So very interesting, to say the least. Well, John, I can't believe how quickly we eclipse a half hour's time. How do you do it, John?
it's like we have never had more of a news buffet than we have now. And there's a lot of dishes that are very exotic that people don't want to touch on. And we touch on them, and we take a big helping of them, and everybody is aghast that we have the audacity to do that. When government makes a mistake, the press has to point it out. As Maya Gay said, that's right. As Maya Gay said, our job is to tell the truth.
That's correct. Well, there are less and less of us. I don't know if we're dying off or we're just not growing them the way we used to. It's going
they're
to be
being
very
sanitized.
To see how it
they're
all goes.
Being sanitized, you know. I mean, how
That's
can
true.
Now? And there's no budget yet.
Correct.
No
right.
New York State budget. I want, and that wasn't even on the front page today of the New York Times. It was nowhere to be found in the darn paper. Where is that budget deal?
They haven't resolved it yet. That's the reason.
No,
they haven't done it.
I mean, that's another bit of fake news. Last week, oh, we have a budget agreement, and he signs the marijuana and all that, and we assumed, oh, there'd be a big announcement by the three cats in a room there, Cuomo,
right.
Stewart Cousins, and Heasty, and but
it isn't
happening yet. Now that means there is a problem. There is a major problem.
Well, we'll be lucky if they resolve it by next Monday. Probably will. John, unfortunately, we've got to go. Bid you adieu. Thank you very, very much. And all the best. Have a great week. Take care, John.
So long, everybody.
Bye.
Mask up. Bye-bye.
Bring in Michael Edelman, who's waiting on the line. Bear with me a moment. Okay. Here with me as we bring him in. Good morning, Mr. Edelman. How are you, sir? For some reason, I could. You're very. You're not clear. No, it's not good at all.
Let's try calling him back.
No. Okay. Thanks so much. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So we're gonna get to. Michael Edelman in a moment. He's calling back. Bad connection, that sometimes happens. So it just is what it is. There he is now. Let's pull him in. Good morning, Michael.
Is that better?
How are you, sir?
Good. Oh, is that better?
Fantastic. It's like
okay.
Perfect.
Good.
Well, first of all, good morning. And
good morning.
I wanted to ask you about what happened with this guy named Noah Green. He's 25. He was named by multiple media sources as a suspected driver who plowed a sedan into a barrier right outside the Capitol on Friday afternoon. And he killed a police officer. And is the nation at each other's throat to such an extent that we can't be civil? Is this the new civility?
Well, I don't think this person is an example of, civility one way or the other. I think he was a troubled individual. I think he committed suicide by cop. He was a worshiper of Farrakhan. So he was just a sick person. This is not a coordinated effort. This is not right wing. This is not domestic terrorism. This is just one guy who actually wanted to die, because you don't drive your car into the Capitol gates and then come out with a knife because you're going to get shot.
That's true.
Was going to happen. That's what he wanted to happen. But having said that, it's unfortunate that the Capitol has to continue to be protected by a high fence, whereas in former times, it's the people's house, and people were free to come and go and visit their legislative leaders and see what the rotunda looked like, and even go to the audience gallery in the House of Representatives, which is quite a trip. I did that, by the way, after I lost the congressional election, and I saw that blue carpet, and I cried.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would, too, if I were you. That's really telling. Do you think that we're going to calm down? Our sensibilities going to eventually calm down?
We're going to be at each other's throats? The problem is you've got an alternative reality being created by news, so-called news outlets on the right. Fox News, OANN, Newsmax, they're in it for the money. They understand they can appeal to gullible people who aren't interested in fact-checking anything, and they just parrot what they hear. And as long as that's the case, as long as we can't agree on a common set of facts, the discussion won't be civil. You're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And that's what Daniel Patrick Moynihan said 4 decades ago.
I remember him.
And it's true today. If you can't agree on what the facts are, there's no point in having a discussion because it'll be irrelevant. And, you know, if you want to, people are still believing the big lie that Trump won the election. Mm-hmm. They're still believing the big lie that there was fraud in Georgia and Arizona and Pennsylvania. It's very interesting that when Hillary Clinton lost those blue states by a tiny, tiny percentage point, less than 1%, the liberals didn't claim fraud. They didn't show up at the inauguration. They didn't accuse Dominion Voting Machine Company and Smartmatic of fixing and switching votes, which, by the way, is going to be a huge lesson to the right-wing media, which has done this, because they're being sued for $1.6 and $2.7 billion. And that includes Jeanine Pirro on Fox, is a named defendant. All right?
That's going to be unbelievable
case.
She
can't afford to pay $1 billion. She can't afford to pay $10 million. She can't afford to do anything, but she's caught because she sold those lies as truth. And now she's got to pay for it.
Yeah. Well, she'll be bankrupt by the time it's all over.
Yeah, and Trump might be bankrupt too.
Yeah,
they're
going to
sue him first. They're going to sue him. There are other lawsuits pending against him personally, by the way.
You predicted that months ago.
Months ago.
That would happen as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have a crystal ball?
I do.
Yeah, evidently, yes. Well, I don't know. I don't even know one that has only one crystal ball. But the fact that I'm honored to know you, who has two, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, one tells me what's going on in politics, and the other tells me what lottery numbers to play. So one has been effective, the other has not so much.
All right, we'll have to worry about that. We never know. Maybe it'll clear up
I never know.
Half a year or so.
You know, if I win the lottery, I can always fly up and do the show from the studio.
Oh, that's great. I like that. Well, wanted to ask you also about Axios. They informed that the U.S. economy has added 916,000 jobs in March. So it reveals that under Biden, the economy has spurred an increase in the reopening and reinvigorating the battered labor market in America.
That's true.
Was this supposed to be expected, or is this really a surprise?
I don't think it's much of a surprise, but, you know, we're getting through the pandemic, and you can't, what you can't do is you can't forecast from day to day. But look, over the weekend, on Saturday, they vaccinated 4 million people just on that one day. And I think we're up to almost 100 million people that with at least one shot in their arm. You can tell, I mean, we're going to restaurants again. We hadn't been to a restaurant for a year, but last week we went. We sat outside. You know, we both have shots. The people we were with had their shots, both shots. So I think slowly but surely what the market is forecasting is that what's going to happen later, not what's happening now. And those 916,000 jobs, those really I don't think are new job creations. I think they are people going back to work in jobs that already existed. You know, I don't think that, you know, you can, as much as I'm cheering Joe Biden to have a successful administration, I don't think he gets the credit for 916,000 new jobs. I just think he gets the credit for restoring stability to the job market so that employers can make plans based on, data that's real rather than watching Donald Trump and the Dr. Atlas talk about nonsense, talk about hydrochloroquine, talk about bleach in your body, talk about sunlight. UV, you know, that was all nonsense, and that made people jittery. Right. It made Wall Street jittery because they couldn't make any plans. They couldn't, you know, now they know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. They know that the vaccines are being given. and they're being given successfully. They know that people with the vaccine are not getting ill, and so they're willing to make rehire. 1 month doesn't tell you anything, so I would wait to next month so we see if there's a trend. Because, you know, what if these 916,000 jobs were just, you know, restaurateurs who were back in business and they called up their wait staff or their kitchen staff and they said, come on back. In that case, that may be it. You know, next month, maybe no jobs or maybe down to 200,000 jobs. So I don't think we're looking at anything until we see it over 2 or 3 or 4 months.
Okay, well, that's what your crystal ball is telling you, so that's important to recognize. Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you about some other things, like New York State. They're trying to close their budget gap and due to federal funds. Their revenues, are they hope, will increase because of the casino gambling. They're also engaging in recreational marijuana. How is that going to, are these appropriate mechanisms for funds that we need, or is it just we have to suffer them because we need the money? Because, you know, what are you going to do if people are going to be smoking while they're driving on pot?
Well, it's legal in Colorado and they haven't had that problem. I'll be honest.
I didn't realize that.
I have a medical marijuana card in my pocket for Florida, and I don't drive. I don't drive stoned, so I don't think it's. I don't think it's a problem, frankly. The government needs money. New York State, they all need money. Every single state needs money, and they, you know, they have. But the marijuana thing is not about money. I don't believe.
What is it about then?
It's about not putting in jail and not giving criminal records to people that are smoking pot because they're not violating. These are not felonies anyway. They're not even misdemeanors anymore. Why are you forcing people to go to the black market to pick up pot, which allows organized crime to make money when you can sell it legally and tax it?
Well, that's for sure. But my concern was
marijuana is no more. It's actually less harmful, in my opinion, than if you're an alcoholic or than if you're smoking 3 packs a day. It can't kill you.
Well, that's for sure.
But those other habits can, and they're legal.
Correct. I was wondering also, aren't there a lot of young children who are selling the drug? Particularly in certain neighborhoods more than in others, and if marijuana is going to be sold through the bodega or something similar to that, are they going to be able to earn a living?
They shouldn't be able to earn a living selling something illegal. This is not a question of them making a living. I don't want to keep young gangsters in business. I'd rather do down here is you've got marijuana dispensaries. And if you have a prescription from your doctor, and if you register with the state, you're allotted so much marijuana, or I don't actually use the flower part of it, but there's vapes, there's edibles, there's the flower, and there's even patches. They have marijuana patches because you got a lot of old people in Florida that they're in pain. All right, and so if you're in pain and you smoke a vape, then you're not in pain, so you feel better. That's not smoking to get high, but there's no reason why marijuana should be illegal. It just shouldn't, because what you're doing is you're forcing people who want to smoke marijuana, just like in Prohibition, okay? In Prohibition, people wanted to drink, and they found a way to drink. And the people that were selling illegal liquor, I won't mention my family on the air, but they had a problem. If you were a bootlegger in the 1930s, you didn't think you were doing anything wrong because you were responding to a demand that was universal in the United States. So they had speakeasies. Then you had J. Edgar Hoover wanted to go after then there wouldn't be organized crime in the United States if it wasn't for prohibition.
Right.
There wouldn't, we wouldn't have a mafia. That's what made the mafia. That's what made the crime families of today were born in the prohibition era of yesterday.
Absolutely. Are we recreating the same thing? Is that why we arrest people for, you know, and put them in prison, and there's no incentive for the people who own the prisons to release them? They're making a good buck by having people there for 30, 40 years.
Well, look, yes, but here's the thing. There has to be a distinction between low-level criminal activity and felony.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody commits a felony, whether it's a illegal possession of a weapon or it's an assault, burglary, robbery,
uh-huh.
rape, the breaks, we used to call it the DA's office, BRREAKS, burglary, robbery, blah, blah, blah. If you do that, you go to prison. That's what you're supposed to do. You don't get a second chance if you're knocking people off, and you know. But if you're selling pot on the side of the street, you shouldn't be in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't go to prison. And if you're committing a minor misdemeanor, you know, like trespass or criminal mischief, you should be punished, but you shouldn't be overly punished. That's not a crime for which you should spend years in jail. There should be other ways to deal with that kind of criminal act. And that's partially why they're making marijuana legal, because if marijuana isn't legal and it's a crime, think of the effect on the dockets of the court. The courts would be totally jammed, which they were.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's why they made marijuana possession non-criminal but still illegal. So that's nuts also, right? So you're making
it
illegal to smoke it, but it's illegal to sell it. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's an oxymoron. If you can buy it and smoke it, you ought to be able to sell it. Somebody ought to be able to sell it without going to jail. Otherwise, what's the point of legalizing buying it?
Well, I hear that in New York City, they're already telling the police officers that if somebody's smoking marijuana on the street,
forget about it.
Just leave it be because it's not they're not to be arrested.
There was one of the media, I think it might have been the Daily News or the Post, I don't know. They had a big picture of a guy lighting up, pot in front of a cop.
Yeah.
And the cop ignored him, which is the way it should have always been.
Right. Unbelievable. Do we go through this cycle, you know, every time there's something new discovered? What's the impetus for it? Is it just to make money?
Well, pot's not new.
No.
You know, the Indians smoked peyote. The Indians in Arizona in the early were using peyote. Drugs aren't new.
Why did we make it illegal?
We made it illegal because there was a misconception promoted by the government in like movies called Reefer Madness, if you remember, that marijuana would make you go nuts and would make you commit crimes and would do this and do that, which is absolutely not the case. That's absolutely not what happens. It makes you chill out and listen to, you know, Beatles music, but it doesn't make you go kill somebody. So, it's a substance. It can be abused like alcohol can be abused, but given that you're not abusing it and you're using it recreationally, you're not going to go out and do anything you wouldn't otherwise do.
Exactly. I want to ask you about something else. I'm not quite sure if you have the expertise for it, but it was like a major thunderstorm over the weekend. Turns out that the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, suggested that his brother or half-brother tried to do something to undermine the security of the country. And President Biden said that he's supportive of Jordan. And, how should we look at that?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on Jordanian affairs, but Abdullah, who's the reigning king, has been a loyal friend of the United States for decades.
Right.
And I'm not sure what the motivation was for attempting a palace coup. Okay, so it was attempted by the I think it was the stepbrother of the king.
Yeah, the stepbrother.
Who is now under house arrest.
Yes.
He claimed that, the government was suppressing freedom and blah, blah, blah. So I don't know his motivation for attempting to overthrow the Jordanian monarch, but he's our friend. And so, he's been, has a peace treaty with Israel. He's been one of the more civil minds in the Mideast when it comes to Israel and when it comes to the Palestinians. He hasn't been a whack job like some of the other leaders have been. And so the coup was unsuccessful. And nor should it have been successful.
Mm-hmm. I got to ask you, even though you're not an expert on the international arena, when it comes to President Biden, are there limits to a president, like him or any other? Like, for example, could we have done anything more in Hong Kong to protect the people from Hong Kong? Or is that like China's turf now?
No, Trump was the president when they stepped all over Hong Kong.
Yes,
Trump
absolutely.
Didn't say a word. He said nothing. He said absolutely
he said
nothing. Yeah,
so Biden,
you say nothing.
Biden
and then
did
you
say.
Give, you, yeah, well, you know, Biden believes in democracy. Trump did not. Trump believed in autocracy. That's what he was going for when he riled up the people on January 6th to attack the Capitol. He wanted to overturn a constitutional obligation of counting already certified ballots. He wanted to disrupt it. Okay, thinking that if he disrupted it and they didn't count the ballots, somehow he would remain in office. Okay, and that's a dumb calculation to make, but it shows that, number one, you don't understand the democratic process, and number two, you don't respect it. Okay, that's one of the reasons Donald Trump is no longer president. He doesn't have a Facebook page to bitch on, and he doesn't have a Twitter account.
Yeah.
So he's pretty much sulking around Mar-a-Lago going to his clubs and playing golf, and that's about it.
Yeah.
He wants to start his own media platform. He'll see that it'll be very short. It'll be a very short media platform because he's not going to get a lot of people to participate, and they're all going to be saying the same thing, and that's his base. 32% of the nation. It's not surprising after Joe McCarthy was, revealed to be somewhat of an autocrat as well. He still had 30% of the nation behind him. Nixon, the day he resigned, still had 35% of the nation behind him.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump still has support. He'll never be president again, though.
I don't think so either. And I don't have a crystal ball. I want to ask
even his
you,
son-in-law's then, running away.
Yeah, that's true as well. I want you to ask you, is it a responsibility of the president, like President Biden, to try to bring the nation together? Or are we going to always be split basically 30-35% that would have backed up Trump, and the other 65-70% would back up Biden? Is that a normal balance?
No, normally, first of all, people that are elected to the Congress or to the Senate talk to each other no matter what side of the aisle they're on. They're civil.
Yeah.
But the Tea Party stopped all that. You got Jim Jordan, you got Matt Gaetz, who will, I believe, have to resign his office for the sexual scandal he's involved in with underage women.
All over the place.
It used to be civil, and now it's more divisive. And the reason it's more divisive, as I said at the top of the show, is because Fox News and Rush Limbaugh before he passed away and other right-wing media people whip up a frenzy among people who have no idea of what the facts are. And they go and they just repeat what they're told. So if they're told that Joe Biden is a socialist, they'll repeat that, even though there's absolutely no evidence at all that he's a socialist. Okay, but they'll repeat it because they want to own the libs, as the saying goes, more than they want to get something done. And that goes for Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows and everybody that was connected to Trump. But now he's gone, and obviously Joe Biden is setting a different tone for the presidency. And hopefully that tone I'm hoping that by the time he gets through with making sure everybody's vaccinated so we can get back to a normal way of living, and with his new infrastructure proposal, where he's going to rebuild roads, bridges, tunnels, railroad tracks, ports, that people will appreciate, even people who are Republican, who supported Trump, will appreciate having a president who puts his money where his mouth is and understands that the economy of the United States needs support, and the infrastructure in the United States needs desperately to be rebuilt because it's been languishing around for the last 100 years. And, you know, it's the 21st century. You should see China's infrastructure. Everything's gleaming new. Everything's brand new. They got high-speed railroads that take you from one city to another in an hour instead of 6 hours. We still have Amtrak. And the old and the Amtrak sometimes can't go more than 45 miles an hour.
That's very, very true. And what about relations with foreign countries, with Europe? Are we in a good place now? Because
better,
Biden,
yeah, better than we were.
Biden's incentives and giving people funding has also incentivized economic, positive flow all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know
if
you get credit for that either.
Sure he does, because Trump withdrew the United States from our allies, and he made nice with autocrats like Putin and Erdogan and Xi and Bolsonaro. And so he admired the way they ran their shows because it's the way he wanted to run his show. He didn't want to answer to the press. He didn't want to be held responsible for anything he did. And that's not the way a democracy runs. And so
no, it doesn't.
Joe Biden understands democracy, and he's entering a rapprochement with our allies so that they can once again trust what the United States says and does, and they can rely on the United States as a reliable partner, which they could not do with Donald Trump as president. All right, and our enemies, our adversaries, I won't call them enemies, understand where the lines are, and hopefully they won't cross them. You know, with Trump, Putin didn't have a line. He could pretty much do anything he wanted.
Yes. That's very true. Does the nation also recognize the divide is with Biden on one side and whoever wants to be the fake god on the other side? Have we settled on this reality?
No, you're always going to have two parties. The problem now is we don't have a functioning conservative party. We have a party that that is still being controlled by Donald Trump. It still believes in conspiracy theories because it listens to Hannity and Pirro, and that's what you've got.
Yeah.
You don't have a legitimate conservative party that is, you know, based on ideological issues. What you do is you have a party that's based on false narratives. And as long as that's the case, there will be division, you know, based on nothing.
Do you think that will continue, or will that dissipate over time as the economics prove to be very productive or productive?
Well, I think it depends on how Joe Biden's plans work out. We don't want to see a resurgence of the nutty Republican Party. I think they're going to kill themselves. They're going to shoot themselves in the foot. They're already doing that. Look at Matt Gaetz. They're running as far as they can away from him.
Well,
so,
Gaetz is a total disaster. I don't know how he got
so
far.
Well, that's right. That's correct.
unbelievable. You know, there isn't enough time really to talk about this, but society is really, it's amazing how these guys get away with this murder, you know, literally assaulting women left and right. I had no idea it was that bad. It seems to getting worse and worse as we hear one story after the next.
Correct.
Well, as usual, Michael Edelman, what a pleasure. Thanks for going beyond the comfort zone today. It's been a pleasure. All the best to you.
Okay. Speak to you next week.
And your family. Thank you.
Right.
Be well. Bye. Okay. Well, let me just quickly see. Bear with me a moment as I pull in our next guest. And I know it's going to be Ms. Bove. So good morning, Ms. Bove. How are you?
Good morning. Very good, thank you. How are you doing today?
Really very good, especially because I know you were going to come on, and I'm very excited about your story because it's so unique. Well, maybe not so unique, but certainly you were able to put a finger on how to move from one positive business mode or modality that you created, and you were able to switch on a dime to something more. So first tell us, what sort of business were you in originally before the present
Lee
Shield?
Sure. First and foremost, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with you. Lee Shield started about a year ago, actually, and we pivoted into the space a group of entrepreneurs that brought, you know, our existing network and skill set, you know, to the table from a place of how can we help and help quickly after all of the personal stories, you know, that how we had been affected, you know, by the pandemic in its early stages before it even escalated into something much greater than had been anticipated. You know, coming from a background in recruitment and building teams for myself and the AI platform more recently that I've been, you know, involved in, and then my co-COO and our an owner and managing member, coming from the restaurant industry and operating multiple locations up and down the East Coast and out all the way to Chicago, looking at, you know, what we were seeing, combining skill sets, combining our joint and joining together our efforts with the networks that we had to quickly pivot into the space from a PPE perspective and get supply to those in need. You know, personally being affected by seeing videos of hospitals where there were gowns that literally, you know, they were using garbage bags and speaking with, you know, one of our first customers and clients was NYSHA, the New York City Housing Authority, and getting them masks quickly when they didn't have access to them. And from there, we grew this into something of, you know, great success where we were able to provide jobs for people. You know, we now have on our payroll almost 60 full-time employees across the country with people that we've never even met in person. We were able to, you know, quickly network through different social media channels and using communication by not just your traditional email, but, you know, WhatsApp chats from a supply perspective to be able to get supply for, you know, masks, gowns, gloves very, very quickly. And coming from an entrepreneurial background, educating ourselves on the products and the needs that our customers were going to have. So our customer base was coming up on, you know, the same exact learning curve that we were. You know, they were in need of supplies that they didn't necessarily have to buy before, or they didn't have the product knowledge on, or the know of what to expect, you know, and gauge of what they were going to need moving forward in terms of the demand. So almost coming across. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
no, finish your thought. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it's kind of being ahead of the curve, on educating them and what it was going to look like was something that we were able to provide value for and really become a reliable source when it came to predicting what they were going to need as well, not only in the present, but moving forward.
If I understand correctly, you and two other restaurateurs somehow got together. And what I don't understand is, are you suggesting, and this is what I infer from your, just your presentation, is that you have the capacity and the skill set. And yet, I would imagine that most people in the restaurant business wouldn't have the skill set. So how is it that you were able to learn it so quickly and recognize that this was the pathway for you to be relevant to the people who needed the product at this particular time and will probably for many years forward? How did you recognize that, and how did you realize that you had the skill set, and what did you have to study to get there?
Sure. Well, it was a very, it was a quick study when it came to product and product knowledge. There were four of us that started out, and I think that half of the team, brought the restaurant background and quickly, overnight was able to recognize that, looking at, just the absolute loss, especially, in New York area with restaurants, closing down, fairly quickly. We were able to, look at previously, rebuilding small businesses and providing to small businesses and knowing the needs of small businesses. The networking came, Michael Sinensky, one of the founding partners previously, and still operates a charity, Friends of Rockaway, that was established, and did a lot of work during Hurricane Sandy. So knowing the immediate needs and assessing those was how this all started. And being able to use and leverage the existing relationships and networks that we didn't necessarily have, in the PPE space to the end result of what was needed was of utmost importance. So the education and being able to look ahead is something that, from an entrepreneurial perspective, you're always looking on how to constantly evolve and stay relevant. So how did we take that and put it into the space, that we wanted to supply to and get there very, very quickly? So immediately coming up to speed on logistics and building a team in order to get product to and fro, and making sure that from a cost perspective that we were, very not only competitive, but, beating, any sort of competition, creating a vetting process to make sure that we were able to, ensure the quality of the product that we were sending, to these frontline workers, to be able to put them at ease and creating that reliability, which is a word that we use, throughout the organization on a whole, is to create that in a world of, uncertainty, sourcing and vetting the high quality protective supplies, and being able to deliver that assurance to our customers, so that they can, depend on it and run their businesses safely and effectively was basically what we were looking to do. And how we could do that to the best of our ability ended up being, something that has grown into, something that we are very, very proud of.
I think you should be. It's an intellectual leap where you came from to where you are at present. So you guys were not averse to study, but you also had the capacity to infer or visualize what the future will hold. But, like some of the restaurants that closed, I only ate there once, so it's not like I was there every week. But the 21 Club closed, and I was just shocked.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about certain companies that can't make it? Is it because a lack of artificial intelligence or something else that they're missing, or is it a question of time? Are they now a little bit too old to do all these things and, you know, to be able to ratchet up your game plan, you need to be a little bit younger.
No, I don't think that that's the case at all. You know, we work with a lot of small businesses, both, you know, that have been around for decades and, you know, those that are new that have been affected the same way. You know, in order to run a business, specifically a restaurant, PPE costs alone can be anywhere between $5 to $10 per employee, which is a hefty cost at the end of the day. And when you're operating on smaller margins, no matter how long you've been around for and limited capacity for dining experiences, especially if you don't have the ability to take your restaurant and your patrons to an outdoor setting or an outdoor environment to dine. No, you were at a loss right there, right off the bat. So I don't think it's necessarily, you know, being out of, it's not necessarily the AI technology. You know, that's a completely separate, you know, piece to our particular business. But if we're going to speak about, you know, the restaurant, it's, you know, everybody's on an equal, you know, playing field. And it's really a matter of, you know, what you can do to pivot. And we did start, you know, an initiative to be able to supply, you know, packages to smaller restaurants in order to take that off of their plate, where we will, you know, you basically be able to go onto our website and select how many employees, you know, that you have and your average business, and we can provide you, you know, for a supply based off of your qualifications in order to at least take that off of your plate. So the playing field and is everybody's experiencing the same. Everybody has the same capacity that they're able to work within. But what can we do as a company, and you know, what can you do to change, you know, the current way of, you know, driving business? And you know, that could be, you know, using technology, say, you know, to enhance your curbside pickup or whatever it is that it might be.
Right.
But you know, the struggle is certainly real across the board.
And so before you got to where you are now, how did you find your partners?
Yeah, so I have been working with our chief revenue officer for about 13 years now. And the restaurant side and the restaurant piece, they've been working together. So Michael Simensky and Erica London have been together for about 15 years, lifelong friends with the senior management team. And then we have crossed paths and shared office space as well in the past. So it was a very easy transition for us all to come together, you know, at this time to be able to start something where we could, you know, combine our efforts in order to make a difference.
And how did you know before you began to pivot that each of these people could lend a helping hand to fill one aspect of what was required? Did you all work out a plan before and then piece it all together? And do you think it's replicable among other people? I think you're just very unique.
Oh, well, thank you for the compliment. No, we certainly all brought a different skill set, you know, to the table, but our combined passion to help was at the forefront, and we very much came from a mindset of all hands on deck. You know, there was nothing that any of us, you know, wouldn't do and still to this day would not do, with 100% complete accessibility to jump on a phone call, to help out in any way possible, to help our team members in any way possible. You know, we originally started by bringing on, you know, a team to outreach and to promote, you know, what we were doing and understand exactly what we were doing. And in doing so, our first three hires were, you know, working moms. And we were able to, you know, provide a work environment for people who, you know, brought their own unique skill sets to the table, you know, whether that came from retail or restaurants or, you know, the pharmaceutical space. It was, you know, it wasn't necessarily your traditional hire in terms of, you know, what you'd be looking for on paper, but personality came into play and everybody was effective and there was so much job loss. And, you know, we were able to, you know, kind of pivot in the direction of an HR, from an HR perspective of, you know, what we were able to attract from a talent pool and do so on a national basis. And then coming from, you know, the restaurant industry, having everything just change, you know, overnight, and bringing that those real-time changes and being able to adapt so quickly, you know, that piece from a leadership perspective was something that was definitely needed, and changing into something new. And then the AI piece was something that we were very well versed in, and having, you know, selling that platform for such a long time, able to, you know, easily transition and use the technology to our advantage. So I think we all individually brought something, but together we're able to create something, like I said, that we are very proud of.
Well, and evidently rightfully so. When you use the word passion, the next word for me was compassion. And then if you have the passion and the compassion, you also beget solution. And evidently you found that on the road. And you also had a grand vision. It was not just a little, you know, like, oh, we're going to open up a store here and we're going to function and we're going to maybe work beyond where we are, like one or two or three or four blocks, that's it. What made you go for the gusto? What made you go large?
Yeah, the compassion is, you know, something that we felt from day one. And it goes back to, you know, everybody has a story. This was not, you know, isolated to a specific city or region or territory. This was a global you know, issue, and how could we touch as many people as possible, no matter what. So we did start, you know, very, very small, and we started out, you know, with a smaller clientele, and then realizing that had the ability to go greater is when we were able to, you know, certainly put, you know, some larger pieces into place when it came to supply. You know, looking at the demand, it was practically endless. So what could we do to make sure that we were able to provide was to put a focus on scaling and scaling, you know, appropriately as well. So it wasn't something that we just did overnight. Hey, we want to go big. That was not the intention at all. The intention was to help as many people as possible, and how we could do so without losing you know, the reliability that we do put such an emphasis on. So how were we able to maintain on a larger scale what we had started on a smaller?
And that makes a lot of sense. So your passport that allows you to enter all these different types of businesses is built on integrity. How did you build integrity so quickly?
Yeah, we created, you know, quite we were able to create a position for ourselves that was, you know, surrounded by integrity, and then basically had that waterfall down into every single person that we were working with and for and to, and creating that message. So, you know, our main focus was to do everything and to do everything, you know, to our best ability and make sure that we were, you know, not letting the ball drop in any aspect. And I think that, you know, that started from the top and just waterfall down in throughout the organization. And in doing so, we were, you know, that was something that was very evident to our customer base, to our clients, to those that were end users, and it ended up being, you know, a point of building relationships as well, where this was not something that we did for one time. You know, this is something that is ongoing for our customers in this relationship. And as things change and as things move and as efforts, you know, went from, you know, prevention to reopening, the need is still there. And it's very real, and the integrity behind it is still the same as it was day one.
What impresses me is the fact that your business model, it seems to me, is one of partnership with other businesses, as opposed to a very successful model such as Amazon. And I saw many retail businesses go out of business. Phenomenally large, big, established names that literally crumpled because the product that was sold at a store ended up also being sold through Amazon. But I guess the retailer, large retailers, didn't have a problem with Amazon selling it beneath their cost factor. How do you maintain that relationship of respect without taking over their business?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, obviously, when everything happened, yes, some of the smaller retailers were not able to necessarily, you know, maintain the operations that they did previously, and the Amazons mm-hmm. of the world were able to, you know, kind of take over where traditional supply had left off. But we put a focus on the relationship part of it, you know, for sure. I think that the level of communication, the level of customer service, you know, not necessarily looking at ourselves as a PPE company, but as a med tech company and somebody who is going to be here, you know, for the long haul, you know, we were there mm-hmm. for these organizations in a complete time of need when their major suppliers were not able to supply to them. And we will continue to be there for them, you know, moving forward, even if that is, you know, in some ways as a second option, you know, for them when, you know, they need something quickly or they know that they can count on us because of the relationship that we have built with them that is one of, you know, integrity and honesty, you know, to be there for the future moving forward. So I think that is actually a way that we set ourselves apart and, you know, how we were able to, you know, be looking ahead, not only from a business perspective, but for the needs of our customers. And that's something that they became something that they can count someone or an organization that they can count on, not only for the short term, but have proven ourselves month over month to be there for them for the long term, you know, at that same level. And that started from the relationships that we build and have built from day one, where, you know, whether or not you are a small business with under 50 people or you are a larger organization, you know, like some of our clients, the Gaps of the world, or, you know, for example, in the medical space, you know, WellStar, one of the largest healthcare networks in the Atlanta area, you know, you have the same level of service as a dentist office, you know, in the tri-state area, with the same type of turnarounds with your product and the same vetting and the same relationships that you have with the internal team here. So I think that is something that, you know, it was a way that we set ourselves aside from, you know, kind of, you know, going online and, you know, click and pick and pack type shipping to your location.
Well, I haven't focused so far on what you've been repeating over and over and over again because everything you spoke of is so salient that I wanted to swallow it and understand and appreciate it. But it seems to me that the foundation for everything you do is your relationship and the trust that you've built. Is that probably the most important thing between companies such as yours and the people you supply? Is that ever forgotten?
It seems no, it is not. It never is, not for one second.
Okay. That's huge. That's very, very unique in business that may be coming out today. I don't think it was as viable or pertinent maybe 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. It should have been. Maybe we didn't emphasize it so much that many years ago. What's changed that we now need to focus on this relationship of trust? Because I think before it was just a financial, that I need for my restaurant, that's what I'll buy, and so on.
Right. Yeah, I think that, you know, we're starting to realize that, you know, trust is a huge factor across the board in business. And we're realizing that as things have evolved and, you know, even getting to a place of where we are today of so many things, you know, being virtual and automated and going back to the real needs of, you know, the relationship aspect of business, you know, can certainly get lost in the day-to-day. But where there's trust, there is reliability. There is, you know, long-standing, solid relationships in business that, you know, words cannot necessarily, you know, describe in just a couple minutes, that the value that should be placed on that. Because at the end of the day, you know, in order for any business to be successful, it's going to rely on the relationships that have been created and have been established over time. And then, you know, that starts with newly created, you know, business ventures for moving forward. It all starts, you know, at day one and evolves from there. So building on that relationship and constantly, you know, nurturing it over time is of utmost importance as well. It's not just the initial establishment of it. It's relationship maintenance that I think plays a big part in setting a business aside, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I love the fact that you love what you do. Not everybody
I do.
feel, but it seems like it permeates every aspect of you. And so how do you ever get any rest? Do you get to sleep at
that's
night?
That's a great question.
Or are you constantly thinking?
Constantly thinking. It has been, to be completely transparent with you, it's been a lot of work, but it is, at the end of the day, so enjoyable that it's not one of, you can't get tired when you really enjoy what you're doing and what you're enjoying every day.
Right.
and the reward of, you know, speaking to customers and clients and knowing, you know, that we have helped them get through some very, very trying times is enough to certainly ensure that
your skill set isn't necessarily taught in college or in higher learning. This must be mom and dad that's helped you come to this place, I would think.
You know my mom and dad because they grew up in Yonkers, coincidentally.
Oh, you're kidding. I didn't realize that.
Well, that's fantastic.
That's a beautiful story. Thank you for mentioning that. What did they infuse you with? Are all these things that you've spoken about, creating trust, creating need, recognizing need, was this all of who they were?
Yes, and still who they are today.
fantastic.
They are. They literally are two of the most compassionate, giving of their time, their resources. They give to people on a daily basis. They coach, they mentor, they are a listening ear, you know, to this day. They are there for me, you know, at the age of 40, like they were for me at the age of 12.
certainly
instilled in myself, my brother, and my sister, you know, nothing but love, kindness, the importance of honesty. And I could sing their praises for your whole next segment.
I could imagine. Well, those are tenets that are rare to find And it's wonderful that you found it in mom and dad. That's beautiful. That's a testimony to them and a testimony to you. I wish I had more time to talk to you. I hope you wouldn't be too shy to consider coming back. We can explore more.
I would absolutely love to.
It's been an absolute pleasure. What a wonderful meeting. Thank you for making the time. All the best, Ms. Bo.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you. Oh, and happy holidays. Forgot this Easter.
Same to you.
And
happy
Passover
holidays.
And all of that stuff. Be good. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Exciting. Ms. Bo, what a fascinating personality. It's just that she exudes all this power and energy and compassion. It is so rare to find nowadays. I sound like an old man. Well, I probably am because I'm probably as old as her parents. So it goes. But that's just between you and I, the listener. So we'll see where it goes from there. Well, let's move on to the next thing. What I want to do is read to you my hesitorial named after me, not because I'm so, enamored by myself, but our readers suggested, hey, with a name like Hezzy, why don't you turn that into a hesitorial? And, you know, hey, they're the boss. And I listened. How could you not listen? So it was really very, very exciting to hear them suggest that. So let me just move on to something else here. Move on to, I'd like to share this with you about Mount Vernon. And I think you'll find it interesting. Bear with me a second here. Okay. Bear with me a moment. So many screens open up that are opened. Okay, this is the hesitorial. I wrote it yesterday afternoon. It's entitled After April Fool's Day, F-U-E-L-S Day, How Come Mount Vernon Lives Do Not Matter? And naturally written by me, Hezzy Harris. Well, April Fool's Day became more serious than it needed to be, with Mount Vernon Comptroller Deborah Reynolds playing a dangerous game of not paying the city's bills, particularly the fuel bill. As a result, public safety was compromised, fuel supply tanks hit empty, emergency service were forced to ration 5 gallons a shift, limiting their ability to respond to a crisis. Mount Vernon was forewarned. The Mount Vernon Inspector General, the IG, issued a detailed report on how Comptroller Reynolds destroyed the city's electronic payment system called MUNIS, M-U-N-I-S, in early 2019. The IG raised red flags, asserting that Mount Vernon's payment system collapsed when Comptroller Reynolds unilaterally moved the electronic payment process to paper, a paper-based arbitrary voucher system. On her many Facebook Lives appearances, Mayor Sean Patterson Howard appealed to the public to urge Governor Andrew Cuomo to remove Comptroller Deborah Reynolds from office, noting that he has an official complaint on his desk since 2018. To date, no official action has been taken in the direction by Albany. Former Mayor Richard Thomas was correct and continues to be exonerated by the consequences of an unchecked Comptroller in Mount Vernon. It certainly looks as if he was politically targeted for crusading to reform a corrupt city hall and raising questions about Mount Vernon's finances. Based on the IG report and New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli's September 2020 audit of Mount Vernon, the Office of Comptroller wrongfully seized control of the Mount Vernon of the Mount Vernon finance going back to 2016. Now, the public was led to believe that the former Mayor Thomas was the cause of turmoil. However, this has been proven not to be true. Old power struggles continue to manifest today through high property taxes, rampant potholes, chaos to the point of near fistfights between Mayor Patterson Howard and Comptroller Reynolds at meetings, and the ridiculous amount of grime littering Mount Vernon streets. Now, Mount Vernon has been lucky that disaster did not strike during the tenuous fuel shortage, as lives could have been lost. Assuming the state of New York does not act, city council and mayor have at least two options available to them to solve the comptroller problem issue and immediately to do so. One is for Mount Vernon to change banks, and the other is to hold Comptroller Reynolds in breach of her fiduciary responsibilities / duties. Curiously, despite being blocked across blocked access to Mount Vernon's finances by the city's own bank, one should know that at a board estimate meeting on March 16th of 2021, Mayor Sean Patterson Howard and City Council President Marcus Griffith said they do not want to change the city's bank. Instead, they declared that they want to give her Comptroller Reynolds another chance by offering olive leaves to work together. And we can watch in disbelief here on the following link, which we supply you with. In contradictory fashion, the same two people, Mayor Sean Patterson Howard and Council President Marcus Griffith, made opposite statements to the Journal News the following week. They indicated that they would do anything and everything to solve Mount Vernon's comptroller problem / issue with Comptroller Reynolds, given the continued threat to public safety. They ignored the above two solutions and took door number three, which was to file a lawsuit only with respect to the fuel bills. To Mount Vernon's benefit, a judge ordered Comptroller Reynolds to pay the fuel bills, which Comptroller Reynolds did, albeit partially. Well, the political perception is that everything is okay. The reality and simple truth is things are not okay. The reality is that the problems / issues with Mount Vernon's comptroller, Deborah Reynolds, continues to worsen, and these issues beg and demand answers to the following questions. One, was a lawsuit meant to distract the people in Mount Vernon from the real problems? And two, why is Mount Vernon City Hall doing nothing to stop Comptroller Reynolds from using a paper-based arbitrary voucher payment system? Why is the electronic payment system, Munis, not being used? And why is City Hall not taking action to hold the city's bank accountable for aiding and abetting the comptroller's egregious behavior? The Mount Vernon City Charter is clear. New reforms require transparency. The obligation to uphold the Constitution is paramount, yet those in office betray their oath to do so. Incident after incident, issue after issue in Mount Vernon, and nothing seems to matter. Repeated dangerous situations, either caused by Comptroller Reynolds or by the lack of action by City Hall, ranging from police, fire, DPW, fuel shortages, $20 million vanishing without a trace from the Mount Vernon School District's account that controller Reynolds controlled the raw sewage invading homes and businesses throughout Mount Vernon. It appears that Mount Vernon lives do not matter enough for City Hall in Albany to exact accountability. Evidence continues to mount that Comptroller Reynolds is jeopardizing Mount Vernon's public health, education system, and general safety. Just as bad is the willful neglect by City Hall officials who do nothing of substance to stop the madness in Mount Vernon. Why? And how come Mount Vernon lives do not matter? So that was the story. And these are corroborating report type is the Mount Vernon Inspector General report. The title is the Mount Vernon's electronic payment system compromised by Comptroller Reynolds. Date issued was February 25 of 2019. And the link is also set aside for you to read. Unbelievable, as they say, just simply unbelievable. Well, today I have to leave early, so we're going to really just end the broadcast early today. I want to thank all our guests. They were just simply marvelous. We were with John Bailey, from the White Plains Citizenet reporter. A pleasure to always speak to him. And then we spoke to national political pundit Mike Edelman Esquire, and he's always a pleasure as well. And then, to my delight, we were introduced for the first time to Amy Bove. She's the co-chief operating officer of We Shield, WESHIELD. So that's our broadcast for today. Hopefully you'll join us tomorrow. And don't remember who's on. Oh, no, forgive me. It's Tuesday tomorrow. So we're going to speak about the Constitution. And the Constitution we're going to discuss with Jeff Swartz, as well as Professor Brendan Beery. They're both with CMU Cooley College campus based out in Tampa, Florida. And we're going to talk to them. And in the second hour, I don't remember who we have. Probably will be me. And actually, let me see if I did write something in our calendar. But I don't think so. Okay, let me look at the calendar for tomorrow. One second. The Constitution. Oh, tomorrow's, forgive me. So we're going to speak to Beery and Swartz about the Constitution. And then at 11 o'clock, it'll just be me. And at 11:30, we're going to speak to Mike Cater. He's the Yonkers City Council president. He's running for re-election. So that should be very, very interesting as well. So there we have it, folks. That's our schedule for tomorrow. Hopefully you'll be able to join us. And again, thanks to all the guests that we had today. They were literally a pleasure, every one. One better than the next, as they say. So let me move back to our studio screen. And one second here. Okay, for some reason, I lost the studio screen. So I'm going to have to move and find it again. Bear with me a second, and hopefully we'll get it. One second here. All right. Once you lose the screen, it takes quite a bit to put it together and find it. I don't know what I did to lose the screen, but did something, that's for sure. Okay, let's see if we can get to the studio screen. Okay. It's like we're moving along the way. So hopefully we'll get there. Gosh. It's really amazing at times. I really wonder, oh, this is great. I've got the studio screen. It's come up. So I want to thank you again for being with us. It's about a quarter to 12. Have a great day. And thank you for being with us. Hopefully we'll be able to speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.